Today is Tuesday, March 13th. We're going to work on respiratory anatomy today. Okay, so on page 67, what we're going to do is take a tour through your respiratory organs as if we were air traveling through your respiratory system. We're going to start off with your upper respiratory passageways first, and then we'll go into the trachea and below, and then we'll be in the lower respiratory passageways. So what we want to think about is, why do we have all of this tubing to pass through? And a lot of the reason is we want to make sure that the air that reaches our lungs is clean, it's warm, it's ready for gas exchange. So that's kind of what the upper respiratory system is going to do. It's going to help make sure that we get clean, ready to exchange gases by the time we get into the lower respiratory system. So let me start you off there on the top of 67 by looking at the nose. And you know, it's kind of interesting. This is the only part of your respiratory system you can actively see. Everything else is inside. So when we're thinking about the nose, we can see our external feature that's made by the nasal bone, by hyaline cartilage. We've also got two external nares or nostrils that allow air to flow into the nasal cavity. So there are internal nares, by the way. They would be the opening here back near the nasopharynx where the air flows into the back part of your throat, that naso and oropharynx region. So there is actually a set of external nostrils or nares and a set of internal nares as well. So why should you breathe through your nose and not through your mouth?
To filter.
Filter, yeah. So what's in your nose that helps you filter that air?
Hairs.
Good. So there's coarse visible hairs in there. What else?
Mucus.
Good. And one more thing.
Cilia.
Good. I'm glad you got that. I'm not a hula dancer, right? Good. So the coarse hairs trap large stuff like dust and debris. The cilia are actually creating a current, and they're sitting on these nasal turbinates and meatae that help to spin that air and make sure that it's cleansed. As air spins through those nasal turbinates, we actually increase the speed, and that slings the dirt and the bacteria against the walls of the sticky mucus. The cilia then take that sticky contaminated mucus and they shove it back toward the back of your throat. It will drip and drain down the uvula, however you want to say it, right? It's a weird word. And then it comes on down your throat. You then make a conscious decision whether or not to cough out that contaminated mucus or whether or not you want to swallow it. A lot of people swallow it and don't even realize they're swallowing contaminated mucus. We will sometimes call it post-nasal drip. And that's just the drainage that's coming out of that nasal cavity. So the interesting thing about those cilia is their job is to push the mucus back. We don't want it necessarily dripping out the nose. On a cold winter morning, though, those cilia are cold too, and they'll not be pushing back as readily. So you may have a drippy, runny winter nose on a cold morning. May not mean that you're sick. It just may mean that your cilia aren't doing their job. So they're actually creating what's called a conveyor belt of mucus. You know, kind of like the grocery store conveyor belts, right? So their job is to convey that mucus to the back, not let it drip out. Okay, so we've got the nasal bone. We've also got a maxilla bone here and the palatine bone toward the back. What do those two bones help create? Roof of your mouth, good. And the fancy name for it is?
Hard palate.
Back here, there is no bone. We call that region
soft palate.
Good. So what is the function of having a palate between your nasal cavity and your oral cavity?
Food
doesn't get in your nose. Yeah. Because that'd be really nasty, right? Yeah. And probably worse than that is having mucus on your food. Yeah. So we don't want that mixing in any direction. Babies born with cleft palates have an incomplete palate formed up there, and that does allow for the mixing of food and mucus or air. So we want to make sure that we repair that and that we have a solid surface between the oral and the nasal cavities.
Is it the hard and soft palate that's not incomplete, or just the hard?
Usually the hard.
Oh, okay.
It's usually the fissure between the maxillary bones that doesn't fuse. Let's see, you also push your tongue to the roof of your mouth when you chew and talk, so there's more to that palate than just keeping those two items separate, food and air.
This soft palate back here, we talked about that little tip ending back there called the uvula. That is more than just a little dangling tip at the back of your throat. That particular piece keeps you from having food enter into your nasal cavity every time you cough or every time you sneeze. And that's an important thing because, again, we're trying to keep that clean air separate away from our food. I don't mean to make you sick. It is getting lunchtime, right? But if you've ever vomited and had food come out your nose, there's so much force. Yeah, that's nasty, isn't it? So much force at that uvula can't keep that area back there shut. But it does serve a function more than just being a little dangling piece at the back of your nasopharynx region. Okay, let's see. Down below, about halfway, you've got the physiology. There's four main jobs here of your nose. The nose filters. We've talked about hairs, mucus, cilia. The nose also helps to warm the air that we breathe. There are capillaries close to the surface of the mucous membrane in that nasal cavity. That allows for the warming sensation of the fluid, you know, moving close to that air before it gets down into the lungs. I know if you go out on a really cold winter morning and take a deep breath, it almost burns your lungs, doesn't it? Okay, so that breathing through the nose helps to warm up that air as well as humidify that air. Of course, we can't forget about the sense of smell is housed in our nose. There are olfactory nerves that carry information back into our brain from the osmoreceptors in our nose, or olfactory receptors rather in our nose. Okay, so just want to mention kind of as a side note, you probably have heard every summer they talk about the brain-eating amoeba. You ever hear about that?
Yeah.
There's always somebody that's, you know, been swimming in some like pond or a lake and now they've come down with this brain-eating amoeba. And the unfortunate thing is the way it gets into your brain, they think, is through your olfactory nerve. So yeah, if you happen to be in, say, an unchlorinated swimming area like a pool that's not properly chlorinated, a lake or a pond, even well water that's perhaps got some of that stuff growing in there, that can hit your olfactory tracts, go back into the brain, and there it is. So,
a little fella a few years ago in our area, that happened to him. He was like 12, and he was jumping into a lake,
mm-hmm.
and that was when, you know, we'd had that drought, and the water had just sat there.
Oh, wow.
And they said it, when it shot up his nose, that's what,
wow.
what happened, and it killed him, unfortunately.
I was going to say, well, that's... They say that's a very hard thing to catch before it gets too late.
Yeah.
Wow. So they say, you know, either don't swim in those kinds of areas, or if you do, try extremely hard, not, like you say, not to get your nose splashed. So, okay, so that now takes us down to the paranasal sinuses. There are four sets of bones that house these empty air pockets. They're not just empty air pockets. They also have mucus in there that is draining into your nasal cavity. Let me give you an easy way to keep the four bones straight. If you remember them as films, that will help you keep the bones straight. That stands for the frontal bone. You've got the ethmoid bone. Good, and one more. Sphenoid, good. Their sinuses do produce mucus. The mucus drains into your nasal cavity by way of very small ducts or passageways. And if those ducts become inflamed, then we feel a sense of pressure in our sinuses because the mucus can't escape. A lot of times people have sinus congestion and pressure around their forehead. That'd be those frontal sinuses. Around the cheekbones would be the maxillaries. And we actively feel congested like we can't breathe when those are filled up with mucus. You can have ethmoid and sphenoid problems as well, but they're kind of back behind the eyes. So a lot of times people complain of having, like, you know, pain back in their head, like an eye headache, and it may in fact be inflammation or swelling in those ethmoid and sphenoid bones. So kind of dangerously close to the brain, right? Because up there sits the brain. I just want to show you this picture, kind of interesting to see the black space on this image is air in the sinus. That's how it's supposed to be. And the opaque one over here means that there's something in there that could be a, you know, blockage, could be like a mucus. They've even had cases where bone grows into those sinuses.
Can that happen with wisdom teeth?
I think they, from what I understand, they can go pretty much anywhere they want to.
Yeah. Ouch. Yeah. I can't imagine life before wisdom teeth removal, what kind of pain people must have been in. Okay, that takes us down to the throat or pharynx region. How about questions so far? So far, so good. Okay. So there are three regions of the pharynx or throat from superior to inferior. Let's start at the top. The most superior region is called what?
Naso.
Naso, good. And then we've got the oropharynx and the most inferior region?
Laryngopharynx.
Good. So laryngopharynx is at the bottom. Let's start by looking at this really busy picture and talk about the nasopharynx region. Up above your soft palate here, we're going to consider this space back here, the nasopharynx region. There's a couple of features here I want to point out to you. One of them is the opening to the auditory or eustachian tube. Where does that tube take us?
The ears.
The ears, good. So right about there, okay. Now, that tube is supposed to equalize pressure on either side of your eardrum, so yawning and chewing and, you know, chewing gum can help us relieve that ear pressure we feel if we see a change in elevation or altitude. Now, I do want to mention a little evil secret about that eustachian tube or auditory tube. In little kids, those tubes sit fairly horizontal, so if you have inflammation or bacteria sitting in your nasopharynx region, all it has to do is travel a horizontal line back into your ear, and then you end up with middle ear problems like otitis media.
Is that where they get like the? Is that where they have the tubes in their ear?
Exactly.
Oh,
yep.
Okay.
They sure do. They put them right in through there. If you're an adult, you know, your face has matured, and so those tubes sit more like slides, horizontal, or not so horizontal, but a little more vertical, and therefore it's a little more difficult for bacteria to climb up those tubes. We tend to see less problems in adults in those tubes than we do see in little kids. And that's the reason. It's just given time for your face to develop. I'm not sure. Let's see if we can see that better with the lights off. I don't think you can see it too well with the lights on. That's a busy mess up in there, but I thought it'd be cool for you to see the opening is kind of there in a groove. Mm-hmm. And sitting right nearby, these are the adenoids or pharyngeal tonsils, as they're also called. What purpose do those adenoids serve? Yeah, they filter and they trap bacteria, and that bacteria could be there from what you're breathing in. So this is kind of a guard shack, you might say. It's a way to trap that stuff before it goes further into your respiratory passageways. So they say that these adenoids tend to atrophy and disappear over time, that, you know, by the time you're an adult, that those tend to shrink a little bit. If you're a child and you have repeated infections, those adenoids can in fact swell so tightly that they block off this breathing passageway. So you can see they should be sitting snug up against the back part of that nasopharynx wall, but they can even swell to the point that you can't breathe through that area above the soft palate. So they do surgeries called tonsillectomies and adenoidectomies. That means that they take out the palatine tonsils here, and they will also take out those adenoids up here. And that's to prevent you from getting, you know, blockages when you're trying to breathe. So important for filtration, getting rid of those bacteria and viruses coming in, but can also be detrimental if you're having a lot of repeated infections. Lights on or lights off?
Lights on.
Off, okay. All right, so what is our next region of the pharynx found behind the mouth area?
Oropharynx,
good. You're gonna have to flip the page with me. Now we have two sets of tonsils. We have a set of palatine tonsils on either side of your throat. These are the ones you can see by saying, ah, and looking in the mirror. And the ones that are much more difficult for us to see of our own are these linguals down here at the base of the tongue. So, you know, kind of think about, you've got all these cleaning stations that are helping to trap bacteria and viruses before that air or even food gets further into the pathway. So we've got three sets of tonsils here. There's actually a total of five. The adenoids are one, You've got a pair of palatines on either side of the throat, and you've got a pair of linguals sitting at the base of the tongue. Okay, so oropharynx is actually a place where food and air can mix. And then we go a little further down, and we're now encountering the larynx region. At this point, you're going to have to route air into the appropriate passageway and food into the posterior tube. So we're now looking at choosing a pathway to follow. All right, so not a whole lot of excitement going on there for the larynx or the laryngopharynx. Any questions so far about the pharynx? All right, so this is the larynx. It is an organ, and as we describe all organs, it's made up of two or more tissue types. There is cartilage here. We've got hyaline cartilage forming this thyroid and cricoid cartilage. We've even got bone. We've got muscle tissue and nervous tissue and other kinds of connective tissue here. So even though it doesn't look like it's all that fancy, the larynx is actually an organ. All right, so let's start at the top. What is the name of this bone? Good. It is unusual because of what? Good. Not attached to anything. You may be able to feel it at the very top of your trachea. It is actually anchored to your tongue, or rather your tongue is anchored to it, and the process of swallowing and talking engages that hyoid bone. So even though it's not attached to any other bone, it's very much an important part of the way our tongues move. Right below, you'll notice a very large shield-shaped piece of cartilage. This one's called what?
Thyroid cartilage.
Thyroid cartilage, good. And the piece on the front? Laryngeal prominence, good. Testosterone makes that prominence protrude further in men. We call it an Adam's apple. Females have thyroid cartilage and a laryngeal prominence. It's just not as pronounced. Down below, we have another piece of cartilage. This one here is called?
Cricoid,
good. And then as you continue down, we actually are getting into a different organ. This down below is what?
Trachea,
good. If you open up the inside and look into the larynx, you'll notice that we have a set of vocal folds or cords right here. They are on either side of an opening called what?
Glottis,
good. And then this piece of cartilage sticking up here is
epiglottis.
And do you recall the type of cartilage it's made of?
Elastin.
I heard the right word, elastic. Right. E for E, right? So elastic cartilage, it's a very flexible piece of cartilage. It does cover up the opening to the glottis every time you swallow. So if you want to experience your epiglottis in action, if you lay your hand over your larynx and swallow, you'll feel the entire larynx mechanism move up. That allows for the epiglottis to cap over the glottis. When you're done swallowing, it's like a trash can lid. It opens back up, and the larynx slides back down. So that's a really complex mechanism to keep us from aspirating or getting food and drink down into our respiratory passageways. All right, so let's see. This openings right here technically is the glottis. That is the pathway of us going with air down into the larynx, or further into the larynx, into the trachea. Some textbooks say that this vocal cord set up on either side is actually part of the glottis, that the glottis is more than just the opening, it's the vocal cords too. So those vocal cords, of course, vibrate to produce speech. We also include our tongue movements and lip movements to produce speech. By themselves, the vocal cords basically produce a buzzing or humming noise. Okay, in this picture, you can see the epiglottis. It's actually sitting down below here. I did want to mention to you the Valsalva's maneuver on your worksheet. We've actually talked about this one before. What do you do with your vocal cords when you perform the Valsalva maneuver? Do you open them or close them?
Close.
Good. So whether or not you realize it, you do this off and on all the time. When people push to have a bowel movement, they close the vocal cords, the Valsalva maneuver, and that actually triggers the vagus nerve. So what can happen to your heart rate and indirectly your blood pressure? Slow down and decrease, right? So we know that the Valsalva maneuver is a way to use your vocal cords
to close them off and increase abdominal pressure. So if you were to bend over and get something out of your book bag right now, pick up a pencil off the floor, you're going to hold your breath, and you do so by using those vocal cords to close off the pathway so the air is staying trapped in your lungs. So pretty cool thing there that we don't even realize we're doing on a daily basis. You may remember a few years ago, Joan Rivers passed away. She was actually having a kind of a look-see at her vocal cords. She had, I believe, a history of polyps on her cords, and they were just looking to see if she had any problems going on there. So she wasn't having any work done on her vocal cords. They were just looking down into her larynx. Well, during the procedure, she was put to sleep. These vocal cords closed. So what does that mean she could no longer do?
Breathe.
No longer breathe, right. So unfortunately, no one on the medical team decided to do what?
Open
them. And in the case that they may not open, what would be a workaround? How could they still let her breathe?
Tracheotomy,
good. So if I fast forward here for just a minute, you'll notice a tracheotomy can be performed. That bypasses the larynx, which sits above the trachea, and would still allow for breathing to occur. They actually did, her family did sue. Her daughter sued, Melissa Rivers. The medical staff that had been working on Joan were actually taking pictures, from what they say, of her undergoing the event, you know, this look-see at her vocal cords. And so they said, you know, somebody should have realized that, hey, you know, we should do something. This would have been a way to help save her life. But unfortunately, she passed away because her vocal cords froze in that closed position. So pretty scary thing there. All right, so let me show you a quick video about those vocal cords.
Think about the trauma we generate in our voice boxes when we talk, sing, laugh, or scream. But take a look down the talented gullet of Steve, Aerosmith's lead singer.
Sorry.
And you get a feel for why he...
Get rid of that. There we go.
And millions of others are wreaking havoc on a delicate instrument.
Okay.
Tonight.
Did it go away?
It almost went away.
Almost went away. All right, slideshow. If I wanted you there, you'd not go there. Still not there. Okay. Let me work on it. I'll get it run for you on Thursday. It's a pretty cool thing because they shine a laryngoscope down Steven Tyler's throat, and you can actually see his vocal cords chopping back and forth, something like thousands of times per second, I believe they say.
Wow.
So it's really cool to see him with his vocal cords there in action. So, almost did it. Oh, there's that. This computer's too smart for its own good, isn't it? Okay, well, I'll get that up and running for you on Thursday. Okay. Oh, now it doesn't want to go to that screen, does it? Like it's frozen. It still doesn't want to display that. Now it's behaving again, that's good. Okay,
So I did want to mention that, you know, when we get down into the larynx, trachea and below, we are looking at ciliated cells. The exception is the vocal cords. They don't have cilia. So if you have mucus land on your vocal cords, you probably know how irritating that can be. To constantly have to clear your throat. That's about the only way, either, you know, coughing or clearing your throat, that you can get mucus off the vocal cords. But pretty much every other part of your respiratory passageway is lined with this ciliated type of epithelial tissue. You may recall from having looked at this stuff in Bio-210, we sometimes jokingly call this the PSCC type of tissue, and that's of course a very long word there. It is pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelial. And when you're looking at it in the trachea now is pushing that cilia and that mucus up towards your mouth. So, you know, we're just looking at the cilia actually moving that mucus in different directions depending on where we're at. Okay, so let's see. Let's go back here. Let's now turn our attention and talk about the trachea for a few minutes. It is a 4-inch long windpipe that emerges on the bottom of your larynx, and it then splits once it's in your chest cavity into smaller and smaller tubes. So this is the first time that we've encountered what we call a patent airway. What does that mean to be a patent airway? Open, good. So if you had an airway that was not standing wide open, what would you have to do to get air into your lungs? Breathe really hard, right? You'd have to work so hard that we would probably pass out and eventually die from having to work against, you know, a closed air pipe. So what we see from this point until we get into the alveoli are open, propped open airways. So what structure helps to prop open our trachea?
The
cartilage. Good. And how are they shaped?
Ring shape.
Ring shape, good. Are they O-rings that travel all the way around the trachea?
Yeah.
Or are they C-rings? They're C-rings. Why is it important that they are C-rings? Good. Got to let food pass along the backside in the esophagus. That's it. So this horseshoe shape is the C-ring of hyaline cartilage that keeps the trachea open in a patent airway. Those C-rings are important for maintaining airflow down to the rest of the respiratory passages. There's a muscle back here on the back. This trachealis muscle can actually constrict or relax based on what kind of nerve stimulation is going on. So if you're excited, if you're in an emergency situation, you may want more air traveling down your trachea. So in that case, what should we do to the diameter of your trachea?
Expand it.
Expand it, right. So if you're into sympathetic mode and you need more oxygen, that trachealis muscle will allow for this trachea to expand in size, getting more air into your lungs. However, if you're in rest and digest mode, parasympathetic mode, what happens to the trachea's diameter? Relaxes, constricts. So that means there's going to be less air moving into the lungs. So we can actually control airflow and diameter simply based on these muscles around the trachea. And you're right, back here on the back side is the esophagus. Large pieces of food at least have room to expand into that back side of the trachea. Okay, so that should take us pretty much through the top of page 69. Let's hit the bronchi next. So a single branch off the trachea is called a bronchus. If you're talking about them together, we would call them
bronchi.
Good. Which of our primary bronchi is wider and shorter? The right primary, good, right there, okay. And the left primary is longer and more narrow, so why the difference?
The heart,
good. So the orientation of the heart creates a little difference there in those two primary bronchi. If people happen to aspirate or inhale food into their lungs, which bronchus do you think is the one where it gets stuck? The right one, yeah, because it's wider. Peppermint candies, you know, the nice round peppermint candies, hot dogs cut into rings are, they say, a pretty perfect fit for those primary bronchi. So it's an unfortunate thing. There are ways to get that stuff out, though. What maneuver can you use to dislodge food stuff there? Good. So how does that work?
Mash.
Squeeze and
push up.
Squeeze and push up. So you're pushing up against the diaphragm, and that's going to dislodge the air in the lungs, using your own air to help push out, hopefully, whatever is stuck in that spot. Yeah. Okay, so we go from the primary bronchi to the next set of branches, and that's called the secondary bronchi. What happens to the diameter?
Smaller,
good. What type of tissue lines these bronchi? That's it, yes, ciliated, that weird one, right? The stuff, pseudostratified. PSCC, yep. And so in which direction are these cilia moving the contaminated mucus?
Up,
good. Up toward your mouth where you either can cough it out or swallow it. We don't want to push it down where it gets further into the smaller passageways. What do those secondary bronchi branch into?
Tertiary.
Good. And the diameter gets?
Smaller.
Even smaller. Good. And then finally, you're going to reach what we call bronchioles. Some of those have the O-rings of cartilage on them, but they start getting so very tiny that even they lose their rings of cartilage. So we do eventually run out of space there for them. All right, so in this picture, you're actually getting a feel for how that branching pattern takes place. Let me draw you down to the bottom there with the bronchioles on the bottom of 69. So the bronchioles are surrounded by little air sacs. Those air sacs are called what?
Alveoli.
Good. You'll notice a term on the bottom of your page called the respiratory tree. Okay, so we are looking now at the very tiniest branches of your respiratory tree. I guess you can look at this and say, yeah, it kind of looks like a tree, right? Okay, so when you get down to those very smallest branches, we will now start seeing some gas exchange take place. But instead of being made of pseudostratified ciliated columnar epithelial tissue, what do you think we are starting to encounter instead?
Simple squamous.
Good. So we need something thinner to do the gas exchange over. Okay. So these bronchioles, these alveoli, are finally in what's called a respiratory zone. That is the last part of your respiratory tree. These are now thin-walled enough for gas exchanges to occur. So flip on over with me. Let's talk about alveoli. They're on the top of the next page. Some people describe them as little grape clusters, and they really do look like grape clusters. They are thin-walled, very small air sacs that surround those bronchioles. The purpose of an alveolus is to do what? Gas exchange. Good. And they're made up of what tissue type?
Simple squamous.
Good. So looking at this picture here, you get a feel for how thin these tissues are. You have a capillary. This is a pulmonary capillary with a simple squamous lining. That's all there is. And it's sitting right here up against an alveolus, and it is also made up of simple squamous. So you're looking at most at two layers of tissue that the gases have to move across in order to exit the alveolus or to enter it. So that's not a whole lot of impediment, you might say, to getting those gases exchanged. By the way, how do the gases move from the blood to the air and back and forth?
Diffusion.
Yeah, it's simply by diffusion. You're right, and those pulmonary capillaries supply the blood gas to the rest of the body. Okay, so we've got alveolus, we've got pulmonary capillaries. In this picture, you can see the setup. What blood gas do we want to move into the bloodstream from the air?
Oxygen.
Good. So we want to get the oxygen into our bloodstream, but we want to dump and get rid of
carbon
dioxide. So it moves from what to what? Capillaries to air or air to capillaries? Carbon dioxide. Capillaries to air. Good. So the CO2 should be moved into the air to exhale. The oxygen should be moved into the blood for transport. Okay. And just to kind of give you a feel for how much exchange power there is in the lungs, healthy lung tissue has the surface area of a football field. That is incredible. Yep, so that's a lot of exchange of gas. That means that we're moving a lot of oxygen in and a lot of CO2 out every time we take a breath of air. Okay, so I just want to point out this pathway here actually shows different kinds of bronchioles, terminal and respiratory. We're not going to distinguish among those types. We're just going to keep it simple and say there's bronchioles, and then the next part are those alveoli. So there's a little more detail here than we're going to go into. All right, so in this picture here, you'll notice there are certain specialized cells embedded among the simple squamous tissue of the alveolar air sacs. Those type 2 cells produce a type of oily secretion called surfactant. So if I can kind of give you a visual image of how this works, if you've ever used Pam cooking spray at home, what are you trying to prevent from happening?
Sticking.
Yeah, you don't want something to stick to your pan. Think of surfactant like Pam cooking spray. It is an oily secretion made by our lungs, and it helps to prevent, guess what?
Sticking.
So what? Sticking to what?
Lungs sticking together.
Lungs sticking together. That's it. So you don't want your moist lung tissues to stick together. If I can take you back to Bio210 for just a moment, you probably learned about a quality of water called cohesion. That means that water molecules like to stick together. And of course, lungs are a very moist environment, and that's going to be a problem. If lung tissue sticks together, that means that they can collapse. So we don't want to have lung collapse. Babies make surfactant by around week 38 of their maturity, you know, during the pregnancy. Babies born very early, like preemie babies, oftentimes don't make enough surfactant. So what major issue do they have if they're born early? Lung issues, yeah, breathing, collapsed lungs. So they can intubate, they can supply a surfactant-like material into the lungs and administer that to keep the lungs inflated until the baby's mature enough and can make their own surfactant. Okay, so let's see. We've got alveolar macrophages next. They are important here because we no longer have what to move out mucus in your alveoli. Yeah, no longer have those cilia. You can see there is no cilia in here, so you know everything from this point into your respiratory system. If you've got bacteria or viruses, how do you get rid of it? You eat it. Yeah, so all of this contamination that we're getting, you know, bronchi, bronchioles, can be swept up to your mouth, but by the time you're in the alveoli, all you can do is use your immune system, let those white blood cells eat the bacteria and the viruses. So, okay, so that takes us near the bottom of your page with the lungs. How about questions so far? Okay, so the lungs are elastic and stretchy organs, and like we discussed with the heart, it's important not only for them to be stretchy, but also to do what? Unstretch, right. So we want them to snap back and recoil. If your lungs lose their elasticity, they lose some of their ability to get the air out of the lungs. And the air that moves out has a lot of what gas?
Carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide, right. So if you lose the elasticity in your lungs, you tend to retain more CO2. That can be a bad thing because it makes your blood become more acidic. Something we'll talk about as we get into things like emphysema. Let's see, we've got an apex, the pointed region that sits up near your collarbone. There is a base. What does your base rest on?
Diaphragm.
Diaphragm, good. Which lung has 3 lobes?
Right.
Good. And why does the left lung only have 2? Good, because of the heart sitting there, good. I hope you've had a chance to see those lungs in the cats in lab. Have you looked at those yet?
Mm-hmm.
Have not? Some of you have?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. Did you happen to have a drinking straw with you?
No, we didn't do that.
Okay. Take a drinking straw with you next time you guys look at cats.
You can take a scalpel and cut the trachea open, insert the drinking straw, and very carefully blow into the lungs. Don't inhale, right? So, yeah. I don't want to put my mouth that close to it, but you know, it's really cool to see those lung lobes blow up. They are totally separate. Yeah. So, y'all get Miss Watson to do it for you. Or if I'm circulating around, call me. I'll come in there and blow up the lungs for you. It's pretty cool. There are two layers of pleura around the lungs. The innermost one is called what?
The visceral.
Visceral. Good. And the outermost one is?
Bile.
Good. And between the two layers?
Serous fluid.
And the function of the serous fluid?
Lubrication.
Lubrication and reducing friction. Good. So they are very close to the pericardium, and I mention that because if somebody has pleurisy or an inflammation of these pleura, that can also lead to pericarditis around the heart. So they're all near very close, and they can spread and share. Okay, so I believe that takes us almost to the bottom of your page. Just wanted to mention there are two major sets of muscles involved in breathing. The one dome-shaped muscle sitting beneath your lungs base is called what?
Diaphragm.
Good. Interestingly, it's both voluntarily and involuntarily controlled skeletal muscle. So unusual in that it's got both of those types of innervations there. And the other sets of muscles that are important are the ones between the ribs.
Intercostals.
Good. You got externals, you're right, and internals. Good. Since we're kind of fresh on thinking about this air pathway, let me take you over to page 72 for just a moment. At the very top of your page is the pathway of oxygen. Let's fill in those blanks. From the nares and nasal, I can talk, it's like a Monday. From the nares and nasal turbinates, the next place we encounter is what?
Nasopharynx.
Nasopharynx, good. Okay, so that first blank there is nasopharynx. All right, from the oropharynx, we then travel into the
laryngopharynx,
good. All right, from the laryngopharynx, we travel into the larynx and the trachea. All right, and our next stop is what type of bronchus?
Primary,
good. All right, so primary, secondary, tertiary bronchi, and then to the
bronchioles,
good. Bronchioles lead us into the air sacs called the alveoli, and now you should find a familiar pathway. We've now joined blood flow. Good, that blank is pulmonary veins. They dump us into what atrium?
Left atrium,
good. All right, so you got left atrium, bicuspid valve, left ventricle, aortic semilunar valve, then aorta. And then we go out for a systemic flow path and end up back in which atrium?
Right atrium,
good. So you can put a star beside that one. That is a guaranteed essay for test number 3. You'll also want to appreciate that the CO2 pathway is just in reverse. And I may ask you somewhere on the test, like I'm in the trachea, it's CO2. What is my next immediate spot? Well, you'd go then to the larynx. Yep. So you'd be moving it in the opposite direction. Good. So to make this easy for you, notice that I start the pathway here with pulmonary capillaries surrounding the alveoli.
if you go and check your oxygen pathway and just run it backwards, from the alveoli, you go to the bronchioles. And just keep on trucking in the backwards direction. And I'll give you a moment in case you'd like to jot that down. So on Thursday, let me tell you where we're heading. We're going to cover respiratory disorders on page 71. We're going to talk through the bottom of 72, and we're going to move into breathing on page 73, 74, and probably get to 75. That's going to be my game plan for you. If you have a chance to look ahead, I think it's probably worthwhile to read through pages 74 and 75, just to kind of get a feel for where we're heading in here. This is a pretty big topic. Do you have any questions on your CO2 pathway in reverse? Y'all good to go? All right, I'll see you on Thursday.